In the coming week, a virtual climate summit is held 5 years after the Paris Agreement. The state of Georgia begins early voting in its Senate runoff race, and Tunisia marks 10 years since the beginning of the events known as the Arab Spring. It's December 10th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, in the coming week, the Climate Ambition Summit 2020 is set to take place virtually 5 years after the Paris Climate Agreement was struck. The United States, during the Trump years, notably withdrew from the International Climate Agreement, and President-elect Biden has vowed to rejoin the pact. So tell us about this summit happening this coming week, Bob.
Sure, Jim. Well, first, it's worth noting yet again, this is a virtual summit. And the virtue of a virtual summit in this regard is that you won't have the sort of incongruous aspect of hundreds, if not thousands of people jetting off using carbon emitting air travel to come to a location, in this case, Paris, to mark the occasion, when in fact, they'll be staying put and in a very climate friendly way, you know, joining into this, this summit and, you know, trying to come to some common cause about what sort of pledges to follow up Paris with. And I guess you could say, despite everything going on and the troubles in the world right now, there is a sense, a whiff of momentum in the climate area. Part of that is certainly the election of President-elect Joe Biden, who's vowed to rejoin the Paris Agreement. And as one of the world's leading carbon emitters, and also one of its leaders in many sort of global initiatives, the U.S. taking this position and already signaling that there will be a U.S. climate envoy means that there could be some real impetus behind whatever pledges are made at the Climate Ambition Summit. I guess ambition is really that crucial word. It certainly does seem like the rest of the world is seized of greater urgency in trying to come to some sort of agreement on curbing carbon emissions, Jim. One quick thing I'll note about Paris, which has been cited repeatedly, which is that when the world leaders came together there, there was this ambition to keep an increase in global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius, or that's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, by the end of the century. That's compared to pre-industrial times. We're already at 1 degree Celsius increase, or slightly over that, according to recent reports. And if you look at the level of emissions, if you look at the extreme climate events, it's kind of a daunting hill to climb or mountain to climb, and action has to happen, you know, pandemic or not.
So, Bob, what is actually going to happen at the summit? Is there an agenda? Are there a series of action items? Or are people going to just sort of renew their stock concerns about the future of our climate?
I think a bit of all those, Jim, but there certainly will be an effort by, let's say, the host nations. In this case, it's the UK and France, with the UN joining as a co-host of the occasion, to come out with firm pledges on greenhouse gas emissions. So the UK is pledging actually 68% cut in such emissions by 2030, which is even higher than the European Union, the bloc that the UK is poised to leave at the end of the year. I think the UK levels are something like 55%, which are still significant, however, and the UN is keen to get countries on record as trying to pledge these decreases. The US is looking to commit its economy to net zero emissions by 2050. You've had some other countries that have been talking about net zero emissions by that time as well. I think South Korea and Japan come to mind. I think China's talking about 2060. So you're going to get this reiteration, I believe, Jim, of those goals, of a commitment to the Paris aims and to the sort of the spirit of the Paris climate commitments, as well as some sort of momentum towards the next formal global summit, which I believe is in Glasgow at the end of 2021. That was delayed from the end of this year. So some sort of through line in terms of commitments that countries plan to make to try to reach these goals, to try to show that there's actually some teeth in their own commitments. And the big thing about Paris to recall is that these are governments volunteering actions. There's no sort of mandated, there's no sort of penalty involved. If you don't meet these goals, it's more of a kind of a naming and shaming exercise. And that only goes so far at the end of the day. It's got to be about sort of positive, committed action. And, you know, I think the other thing to note in terms of your question, Jim, is whether or not there will be countries stepping forward and saying we've got to go further. We've got to get more ambitious. Some people have mentioned that, you know, in fact, the 2 degrees goal is, which is a long-term goal, is all well and good, but we really need a 1.5 degree Celsius cap on the global rise in temperatures and global warming. And that's seen as almost unattainable given the current trajectory of carbon emissions.
Bob, how much progress are we actually making in reducing emissions of heat-trapping gases? I ask that because the UN put a report this week that said that greenhouse gas emissions had hit a new high last year, putting the world on track for an average temperature rise of 3 degrees Celsius. That's well above both of the targets you've noted. On the other hand, I read that U.S. emissions are projected to drop something on the order of 11% this year. That's not because we've come up with new, cleaner energy, but because the pandemic has choked economic activity, which is not really how you want to go about solving the climate problem. And as you mentioned, the pledges we've heard at Paris are just that, pledges. It's easy to say we're going to get to carbon neutrality by 2040, 2050, 2060. That doesn't mean you're actually going to get there. So are we making any progress?
You know, it's hard to point optimistically to progress. I think what many people who study this stuff very closely would point to are trend lines on renewables in sort of major industrial countries. In terms of just straight figures, though, what you point to and what the UN has flagged is correct. That the world is on track. If it stays at the current sort of status quo pace of some increase in renewables and some winnowing down of coal industries and so forth, it's just not going to be enough to cut those figures down. Warming is going to take place on the path you suggest. It's interesting to note that I think they've estimated now that the slowdown in activity and travel and so forth caused by the pandemic has caused a reduction of emissions by something like 7 to 7.5% this in 2020. But they are saying this report that the UN just recently came out with said that humans would need to collectively cut emissions by close to these same amounts, 7 to 7.5% every year over a number of years to begin to meet the Paris Agreement's goals. And the Paris Agreement goals, by the way, were considered to be modest. Like they weren't considered to be enough to really make meaningful changes that would curb just the absolute level of emissions being pumped out that are seen as a direct cause of the warming trends, which in themselves are seen as contributing to the rising pace of extreme climate events. On the latter, Jim, I think it's undeniable, even the greatest climate skeptics and those who would not point to a human-caused change in climate, to point to the extreme weather events that we've started to see in such great numbers, whether it's the intense fires in places like Australia and California, the warming of the Arctic, the accelerated warming of the Arctic, the recording of 100 degree temperatures in the Arctic, for example, the rise of sea levels, the intensity of storms this past year had, I think, the most ever hurricanes reported since they've been taking records on hurricanes in the Western Hemisphere, and on and on. So those things are happening now. I think it's a question of, again, back to this ambition on the coming weekend, Jim. It's really about our countries seized of it. Is there enough momentum to really propel them towards making these zero emission targets, and then to sort of create some sort of a collective sense of winnowing the world off of a fossil fuel reliance?
You're right, Bob. Climate disruption is not a problem that's going to happen tomorrow. It's a problem that's happening here and today, and we're going to see more significant consequences in the months and years to come.
Well, Jim, I'm going to pull our conversation back to the ongoing political competition in the U.S. We've been sort of almost tracking it on this podcast now for several consecutive weeks. Several of the big things upcoming. We have the starting of the vote in the state of Georgia, not the country. Early voting is set to begin on the 14th of December. And that's also the date in which the Electoral College is going to meet in each U.S. state to cast final votes. But let's start with the runoff race, Jim. What do we need to know about the race and the significance for the U.S. Senate?
Bob, the vote in Georgia for the two Senate seats is incredibly significant. It's about control of the Senate, how Vice President Kamala Harris is going to be spending her time, and the fate of much of President-elect Joe Biden's domestic and foreign policy agenda, particularly actions he hopes to take on climate change. If the Democrats win both seats, then the seats in the Senate will be split 50-50. And since under the Constitution, the Vice President is the presiding officer of the Senate, that means the Democrats will control the institution. They get to pick committee chairs and the rest. Obviously, being in the majority is a big deal. If the Republicans win one or both of those seats, then the Republicans will control the Senate. Mitch McConnell will continue as majority leader. And I think the betting money is that Mitch McConnell will see Republicans' interests lying in opposing much of Joe Biden's agenda, not facilitating it.
So just on the climate front then, Jim, for example, so while Joe Biden can name a climate envoy, John Kerry, any sort of serious initiatives involving funding would have to come through the Senate, and the Senate would have a blocking capability. Is that right?
Correct. Anything that Joe Biden wants to do on climate change that requires changing U.S. law or requires appropriations means that you have to get Congress to go along. Now, if the Democrats control both chambers, it'll still be difficult to get things done because, again, the Senate to some extent operates as a supermajority. If you don't have 60 votes, it's hard to move. But if the Republicans are the majority in the United States Senate, it's going to be hard to get anything done. Because, again, we've talked about many times on this podcast, Republicans are in a different space right now and have been for a long time on climate change compared to where Democrats are. But climate change is just one of the issues that could sort of be run aground for the Biden administration if the Republicans retain control of the Senate. So this is why it's a big deal in Georgia. I think the betting money is that the Republicans will win one, if not both seats, even though polls right now show both races being neck and neck. I think one of the reasons for the pessimism by the Democrats' chances is that Georgia has been a red state for quite some time. In recent runoff elections, the Republican candidate has won, I think, 7 out of the last 8 times in Georgia. And if you look back to the election that was held on November 3rd, both of the Democratic Senate candidates, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, ran behind Joe Biden in Georgia. So that's the reason for, I think, a considerable amount of pessimism. There's one additional thing. The vote on November 3rd was an incredibly high turnout election. You had something on the order of 68% of eligible Georgians coming out to vote. No one expects the vote to be that high this time around. If you go back to the 2018 midterm elections, which at that time featured a race for the governorship in Georgia, which featured Brian Kemp, who won against Stacey Abrams, that had 54% turnout. It's not even clear that Democrats and Republicans will get to that number this time around. So in some sense, you're really talking about a different electorate voting in this runoff election than voted in the election that gave us the runoff. Now, obviously, money's pouring in from Republicans and Democrats. Can't imagine what it's like to be trying to watch TV in Georgia. You're probably inundated with commercials on endless loops. And we're going to find out how this all plays out. Actually, in Georgia, absentee ballots were available in the middle of November. We're now in the part where we get early in-person voting. And there's one wild card hanging over all of this, and that is President Trump's persistent and continued attacks on the integrity of the voting system. The president has been pounding the table with no evidence that the vote in Georgia was rigged, which then raises the question of whether that will depress the turnout of Republicans. After all, if the fix is in and if the Democrats can use voting machines to switch results, why bother getting out of your house, going to the voting booth and casting a ballot? I think that's the big question that's hanging over this election, which is why people know what the conventional wisdom says, but they're prepared to be surprised.
Wild card indeed, Jim. We've had this, you know, incredibly unusual spectacle of Republican electoral officials in Georgia expressing exasperation at the challenge to the certified results that they have overseen. And they in turn facing threats, including physical threats, for sticking to their principles, really, and trying to usher through what has seen across the board as a legitimate election. So it's going to be very interesting. I would just add on top of it all, you have sort of spiking levels of the coronavirus pandemic that are far exceed what we saw on November 3rd. I'm not sure exactly how the levels are in Georgia, but it's sort of a nationwide phenomenon right now. That will be interesting to see in terms of the turnout issue as well. So the country is going through one more series of turns in the roller coaster, Jim.
Bob, you're quite right to flag the role played by Georgia state election officials. They have really displayed profiles and courage. I would note Gabriel Sterling, who oversees voting security in the state of Georgia, who gave a quite emotional appeal to President Trump to stop attacking the integrity of the elections in Georgia. And as Mr. Sterling noted, the vote in Georgia has been counted not once, not twice, but 3 times. And all 3 times, the result came out the same way. Joe Biden won the state. Donald Trump didn't.
I would just add one final thing on that, Jim, which is that obviously being in the United States, we are immersed in this issue and it's raising temperatures across the board for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, if the legacy of this election is that there is a large part of the population that the doubts are the integrity of our electoral system, it puts us as a democracy in a very weak place and in a very treacherous place, certainly not in a place to be kind of a standard bearer for democratic reforms around the world.
Couldn't have said it better, Bob. But let's shift gears and talk about an upcoming anniversary. This December 17th marks 10 years since the start of the Arab Spring. The ramifications of the Arab Spring were felt throughout the Middle East and North Africa as the revolution in the region toppled some long-standing authoritarian regimes. Let's look back before looking forward, Bob. Could you start by talking a bit about the beginning of the Arab Spring?
Sure, Jim. I guess I'll start by saying the term Arab Spring, I think, started to emerge as the events that were kicked off in Tunisia 10 years ago next week spread to Egypt. And Egypt was kind of the big enchilada, so to speak, in terms of what events there eventually leading to the step down of Hosni Mubarak. And you had this huge surge in street protests, in social media campaigns and so forth. And the term Arab Spring kind of took over then. But certainly the events in Tunisia were significant for all sorts of reasons. It was a exasperated, outraged fruit seller named Mohamed Bouazizi, who decided to commit self-immolation after a series of run-ins with authorities that he saw as demeaning and unfair and corrupt. It was not a demonstration that was done for the cameras by any extent, and Mr. Bouazizi died of his wounds in the first week in January 2011, but it did still serve to kick off this protest movement that ended in the ouster of President Ben Ali, and he had been in power for 23 years. It spread across the country. Tunisia to this day remains the biggest and I guess the only success story in terms of a pro-democracy movement that took seed relatively conflict-free. And even though the country faces a lot of challenges on the economic front, in particular, Jim, it is still seen as a place that has some hope and some opportunity for its people that it did not have 10 years ago. The rest of the region, you know, we can just sort of say, has been a bit of a disaster. Wherever you want to look, Egypt's human rights situation, you could argue, is worse than it was in those last years of Mubarak under current President el-Sisi. Syria has been probably the worst humanitarian crisis caused by those events in terms of the civil war, leading to huge displacement of people, millions of refugees, 380,000 to 400,000 deaths, ongoing unresolved civil war there, although the regime of Assad seems to be closing in on the last pockets of resistance at this point, but also the scene for a proxy war that's just been disastrous for Syria. Yemen, close second in terms of the humanitarian disaster as well. Libya, factionalized, relatively lawless in certain parts, another place where proxy wars could be playing out bigger, and on and on. If you look at the benchmarks for human development in terms of human rights, press freedoms, and so forth, inequality, they are all trending very poorly in these countries in particular that were initially caught up in the gust of the Arab Spring revolts 10 years ago, Jim.
Well, Bob, as our colleague Stephen Cook titled his book about the Arab Spring, it was a false dawn.
Yeah. And Stephen, who had a particularly personal experience in the demonstrations in Tahrir Square in Egypt, and who tracked it, you know, extremely closely, even 5 years after, as they were marking the fifth year anniversary, it was clear that the events that were, again, treated so breathlessly and understandably so by many at the time were just not sustainable. And it continues to create questions about what is it going to take to get these sort of calcified leaderships to move in a way that will create some hope. We should also note that as it was 10 years ago, these are societies like other Arab societies that didn't have the tumult of the Arab Spring, where the youth population is really large. Something like 60% of the population on a broad swath of the Middle East is under 30 years old. Jim, we've talked our way into the figure of the week portion of the podcast. Let's start with our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected the figure 10, as in 10 Iranian oil tankers. Why is that a significant figure, Jim?
It's a significant figure, Bob, because it is a Coles to Newcastle story. Iran is sending 10 tankers of fuel oil to Venezuela. Now, keep in mind that Venezuela has the world's largest proven oil reserves. Yep, Venezuela has more oil than Saudi Arabia does. Venezuela was once a top supplier of crude oil to the United States, among other countries, and it also boasted to having some of the lowest gasoline prices in the world. But today, Venezuela is barely capable of producing any fuel at all. The Maduro government blames U.S. sanctions for its current plight, and those sanctions have helped cripple the oil industry. But the problems with Venezuela's oil industry are mostly a result of the Maduro government's vast and sustained ineptitude. Iran is stepping into the breach to provide fuel oil because even China and Russia don't want to cross the United States on trade with Venezuela. I would also note that both Beijing and Moscow have provided extensive aid to Venezuela in the past, aid that has no prospect of being repaid. Now, this is not the first Iranian flotilla headed toward Caracas. The Iranians sent smaller flotillas in May and October. That fuel has already been used up. It's expected that the Iranians will take some crude oil from Venezuela back with them on their return and help Venezuela sell its oil in the markets. The bigger picture, again, is that it is testament to how damaged the Venezuelan economy is. And I know last week we talked about the vote in Venezuela, which the Democratic opposition decided to boycott, understandably so. But we look at a Venezuela that was once a functioning democracy and today is just a shadow of itself.
Yeah, and it's been a goal of the U.S. administration to put Venezuela into a closing box in a way through sanctions, through rallying other countries in the region to cut off, you know, certain material to the elites. And yet it maintains these ties with countries like Iran, with countries like China and Russia that sort of keep it afloat, which is, I guess, sort of a standard approach in the playbook of an authoritarian regime to find common cause.
Certainly, Bob, if you're Venezuela, you are down to only a few countries that you can possibly interact with economically. And so you're trading with the Iranians because the Iranians are also on the outs with the United States. These imports of fuel from Iran may help keep the Venezuelan economy going, but it is only going to limp forward. The manifest problems in Venezuela are going to persist. And unfortunately, the Democratic opposition has not been able to wrest power from Maduro, who's been able to sustain his rule despite the manifest problems coming from his government. But what about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number. It is 23, as in $23 billion, which is the amount of a military sale that appears to be going forward between the Trump administration and the United Arab Emirates. There was a vote this week in the Senate on resolutions of disapproval, but the resolutions failed on very tight votes. And it means that unless there's further movement afoot, the U.S. is going to go forward with the sale to the UAE that includes 50 F-35 jets and 18 Reaper drones, Hellfire missiles, and really a level of sophisticated military weaponry that the UAE and really much of the region has not seen before. This is in part a response to the UAE going ahead and signing the Abraham Peace Accords with Israel, which opened the way for normalization of their relations. And the U.S. wanted to follow suit and reward that. There was concern even on the Israeli side about the level of sophisticated weaponry going to the UAE, but the administration and others said there were enough assurances involved on the U.S. side towards Israel's military edge and its general security that they should not see this as a security threat. Others in the Senate, mostly Democrats, pointed to concerns about the UAE turning around and using this weaponry in other ways, such as in Yemen, where it has been involved in fighting against the Houthis, the Shiite Houthi rebel forces there. And also potentially, you know, losing some of this very high-tech weaponry on the battlefield, where forces such as Al-Qaeda affiliates or even ISIS affiliates could get a hold of it and themselves gain insight into, say, you know, a sophisticated drone and sort of, you know, reverse engineer it and use it against U.S. or U.S. allies.
Any sense, Bob, whether a Biden administration might reverse course or can it reverse course when it comes to office?
From what I've seen, it would be very difficult to do, which is one of the reasons why the sale has been kind of hurried through at this juncture. According to U.S. law, Jim, the window for blocking the sales actually ends December 10th. So it does not look like the Biden administration can take those steps.
Okay.
Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person, and it is General Lloyd Austin. He is President-elect Joe Biden's nominee to be the next Secretary of Defense. General Austin has a distinguished career. He's a native of Mobile, Alabama. He graduated from West Point in 1975, rising all the way to becoming a four-star along the way. He commanded U.S. forces in Iraq. He also became the head of U.S. Central Command. That is the combatant command that oversees U.S. operations in the Middle East. And normally you would anticipate such an appointment to be met with a lot of applause. But the fact that Joe Biden had to write an op-ed for The Atlantic explaining why he selected General Austin to be his choice as Secretary of Defense tells you that there's been some pushback on the selection. And it has to do with a big question that goes to the heart of civil-military relations, and that is, should a retired general be Secretary of Defense? As a matter of U.S. law, a retired general can be named Secretary of Defense only if he or she someday has been retired for at least 7 years. That's not the case with General Austin. He retired 4 years ago. So in that case, it's not just a matter of whether the Senate accepts the nomination. You have to get a separate law passed by Congress, the House and Senate, providing a waiver. Now, that's been done twice in U.S. history. First time was in 1950 with General George C. Marshall, who had previously been the man who oversaw the U.S. military effort in World War II and then was Secretary of State. You may know him from one of his most successful policies, the Marshall Plan. But until 2017, that had never been repeated. And of course, it was repeated in 2017 with Donald Trump's nomination of General James Mattis to be his first Secretary of Defense. Now, there's been an outpouring of criticism, largely in Democratic circles, not necessarily in Republican circles, again, about the propriety of having a military person who's only recently left service to be overseeing former colleagues. And of course, there's a big issue of civil-military relations. And one of the things that's sort of central to U.S. politics and sort of the theory of American politics is to have rock-solid civilian control of the military. And so a number of senators on the Democratic side had voted against Jim Mattis back in 2017, arguing that they did not believe a recently retired general should be in charge of the Defense Department, or they voted for him and said they were doing this as a one-off. And so there's going to be a bit more headwind for General Austin's nomination to be Secretary of Defense than you would normally anticipate. I suspect at the end of the day, the Biden team will get its way for a whole variety of reasons, but it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out.
So Jim, a lot of strong candidates out there and names surfaced in this process. Certainly General Austin's qualifications are clear, although given the extraordinary steps that'll have to be taken, it's a question about why the president-elect felt like he was the best person for the position. And many have pointed to the fact that they had worked together on, when President-elect Biden was vice president, on policy regarding U.S. wars abroad in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is there an anticipation that there's going to be some sort of a special U.S. action that might follow the Trump administration's sort of winnowing down of its battlefield presence that somebody like General Austin will be specially suited for?
Bob, you are quite right that General Austin will have substantial credibility with members of the uniformed military in making decisions about downsizing or increasing or redeploying U.S. troops. I can't say to what extent that influenced President-elect Biden in his choice. He didn't mention it specifically in his op-ed in The Atlantic. But I do want to draw out a implicit point that you just made, which is that it is clear from selecting General Austin and other selections that the president-elect has made is that he really wants to staff his administration with people he knows well. Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, he's worked with for several decades. Ron Klain, his chief of staff, someone he has worked with for decades. He just picked Susan Rice to be his domestic policy chief. Now, Susan historically has worked foreign policy issues, and she has worked closely with the president-elect on that. He's asked her to step in and handle the lead on domestic policy. The president-elect similarly has asked Dennis McDonough, former chief of staff in the Obama White House, to be his Secretary of Veteran Affairs. And as you go across the picks, what you're seeing is that Joe Biden wants a team of people he knows well, he's worked with, and have worked with each other. So I think part of the hope there, the calculation, is you need a team that knows each other to be successful. And this is quite different than, let's say, the Trump approach to staffing the administration. I'll give you just one example. It's a pretty well-known one. Donald Trump had no relationship with Rex Tillerson before naming him Secretary of State. So quite clearly with Joe Biden, a very different approach. They're hoping to hit the ground running and to make headway on the vast array of issues in their inbox.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The presidents of Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Colombia meet remotely for a summit. Vladimir Putin is set to give Russia's annual Constitution Day address. And the Jewish festival of Hanukkah is celebrated.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Cara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.